Yoga Vashishta, Part 15 by Swami Surya Devananda. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge and known, seer, sight and seen, doer, doing and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. The last time, we discussed three things: the state of quiescence or quietude or inner quiet, going beyond the no mind, and reality, the seed for consciousness. Today, we are going to sort of have an overview of the important teachings of the fifth chapter, which we have been on. So we'll backtrack a little bit and try and regroup and bring all these thoughts together. This will be divided in two portions. The first six are sort of looking back, and the seventh one is about what needs to happen as we strengthen all these points that we have discussed lightly earlier. One, the state of pure being. Two, attain a quiet mind first. Three, inner ascent. 4. Control of mind. 5. Cause and cure of samsara. 6. Avoid conceptualization. And 7. Relentless self-inquiry. Let us begin with the first topic for the day, the state of pure being. A thought before we begin. The mind that attains to perfect peace soon attains the pure state where appearances do not affect the reality in which one abides. Greetings. Let us begin with this first topic that we have laid out. We have quite a few to cover. As we discussed earlier, we are going through an overview of the teachings of the fifth chapter before moving on. And as I've mentioned before, it may seem redundant. Some of the things that we talk about now, we may have talked about before, but there's no other way, because the truth is really quite simple. We have to overcome our own conditioning. We have to go beyond it, leaving our conditioning behind, so the truth of our own nature can be seen. And for this, we have to come at this untruth or what stands in the way from many different angles. And in that, there might be redundancy, but that's not important because the main points have to be driven home again and again till they get firmly seated. Now, what is the state of pure being? Simply put, pure being is a state where one does not experience sorrow again. This is a very important thing. You might think it is some otherworldly thing. Well, it's not. Where one does not experience sorrow, there may be sorrow within ourselves. We are aware of the sorrow. Whenever there is any bit of sorrow within, we are also aware of the sorrow. That which is aware of the sorrow or of sorrow is not sorrowful. If it is sorrowful, it can never be aware of sorrow. It has to be beyond sorrow for it to be aware of sorrow. What is that which is aware of sorrow within ourselves? That awareness, that state of pure being, is untouched by sorrow because it is aware of sorrow. See, my friends, sorrow is a reaction of the mind to its own notions and not dependent on any circumstance or anything that happens. You have the mind and you have all of its notions of things. This is good, this is not good. This I must have, this I must avoid. What I must have, we have convinced ourselves promotes joy. And what I should avoid, we have convinced ourselves disallows joy, or promotes unhappiness, or promotes sorrow. So these are the notions in our own mind. But there is something that is aware of these notions. What is that? And why is it that our center of gravity or sense of being is not anchored on that, which is more stable, more durable, and does not fluctuate or oscillate with the highs and lows of I like and I do not like, and this has come and this has not come? It doesn't mean that we stop life. We continue to do what needs to be done as it unfolds. But the question is, some things turn out one way and some things turn out the other way. That does not stop us from being persistent and continuing to do what needs to be done. But there has to be a way to continue without the fluctuation and oscillation in the mind, or without being dependent on others, circumstances, or things. That is the key. Can we find a way to live where we can do very efficiently, very wholeheartedly, in all the aspects of our life, whatever needs to be done, as it needs to be done, without being dependent on these notions, without being dependent on other circumstances or things, just to do what needs to be done on its own merit? As we do that, my friends, the mind stops reacting to itself. When you don't give in to all of these likes and dislikes, the mind stops reacting to itself and it regroups and begins to rest in itself. The mind is scattered. That which wants and that which experiences unhappiness are the same thing. The wanter, the one who says these are the rules, are the one that suffers by the rules. When we start doing what needs to be done on its own merit, not because it promotes my happiness, not because it disallows something else, none of that stuff, on its own merit, then when the likes and dislikes are taken out, we do things wholeheartedly. Why? Because it needs to be done. Then gradually the mind stops reacting to itself, because we are not fueling that separation and fragmentation in the mind. And then it starts to regroup, which is called resting in itself. When the mind rests in itself, everything is reflected just as objects are reflected in a mirror, and the mind attains to peace. The mind attains to peace when it stops reacting to its own notions, to its own baggage. And unpeace or disharmony is the reaction of the mind to its own notions. This is something that has to be driven in again and again till we adopt a healthier way of living. The mind that attains to perfect peace soon attains to the pure state, where appearances do not affect the reality and in which one abides. Let the appearances be there. Let the sorrow, let all of those things be there. The question is, we are aware of it. Can we abide in that awareness and continue to function, doing what needs to be done wholeheartedly, while resting in our own nature? Gradually, these notions will start weakening by disuse. This promotes that for this, this for that purpose. All of that extra baggage, the whole lot of it, will start weakening by disuse. When the waters become calm, the bottom is seen. Just like in a river or in a pond, when the surface is calm, the bottom can be seen. So there's much work to be done in seeing the bottom, in meditation, in all of that. But none of that can happen till we stir up the mind and till this fragmentation exists. This brings us to the second point for the day. Attain a quiet mind first. A thought before we begin. Just as in a calm and placid pond, reflections are seen without distortion, quiescence of mind and knowledge of truth are interdependent. Let us build on what we have just spoken about. A noisy mind is a mind where the energy built up in the mind feeds on conditioning, and conditioning feeds on energy. Conditioning has been built by energy in consciousness. Our likes and dislikes and all of that have been the energy that has built it. Our likes have energy, our dislikes have energy. When that energy moves in consciousness, it apparently, but not in truth, forms these separations or grooves and sort of lumps parts and bits to it that is experienced as conditioning. All this happens in consciousness. That's why it seems so very real. There is no other plane for all of this to happen. Energy is built up by a wrong notion, a erroneous notion towards things. This is favorable, or this I like. This is unfavorable, and this I don't like. And by that I that is before the like and don't like, the I splits its own self. The I becomes fragmentation. Ultimately, we are reacting to our own notions within our own self. There is nothing else that is going on. All sorrow, all grief, all suffering, all confusion, all disharmony is our own reaction to our own notions or our own conditioning in our own mind. If it wasn't so, we could never have gone beyond that. And we do go beyond that in a lot of examples. Let me give you a simple example. Say you are driving to work, and there's heavy traffic today. In this heavy traffic, you know that you have to be at work by a certain time. There's a very important meeting that you have to attend. So you constantly check the traffic, you're listening to the radio and things like that, and you go up and down mentally and emotionally, waiting for this traffic to clear because you want to be at work. As simple as that. And you keep thinking about, what if I don't make this meeting? What if I am late? What if everything else? And the consequences of all of that stuff and all of the stuff associated with it. Now, let us think about a second situation. You're also driving to work, but as you're driving to work, the same conditions, you've got a lot of traffic on the road. But you also understand somehow deeply that you've got a good team and the people can continue while you're driving to work or getting there, and it's understandable. People understand that in this traffic, it's not easy to get there. Or say you have a phone and you're able to call in that you might be a little bit late and notify people. And so you keep driving. Now the dynamics are the same. In the first instance, maybe you didn't have a phone with you or you couldn't make a call. And so there was all this stress because of the uncertainty that you associated with the events, natural events that were happening. In the second situation, the uncertainty has been resolved, though the dynamics of both the situations are identical. You're driving, there's a lot of traffic, that traffic seems to trigger a lot of anguish and all of that. On one, there's uncertainty because you don't know how things can unfold with you not being able to notify others. On the second, with being able to notify others, the same dynamics, but there's a certainty, so you can concentrate on driving carefully and get there when you get there and do what needs to be done as it's done. What is the difference between these two? One has stress, one has no stress. Just what is? The situation is the same. So is the situation responsible in any way for the uncertainty that we feel in our mind, that we experience in our mind? No. On one, there is no assurance at all. There is uncertainty because nobody knows and you don't know how things could happen. You haven't informed anybody. So there is a cloud of uncertainty. On the second, you've informed people and there's nothing you can do about it and you've accepted that. Once you accept that within yourself, that it's raining, the roads and traffic conditions are bad, and you drive slowly. So there's no stress. What has changed? The outer hasn't changed, but there's been an inner realignment, and that inner steadiness is what gives peace, and that inner unsteadiness or instability is what promotes restlessness, anguish, and all the rest of it. So this is where we get back. Energy is built up by erroneous attitude towards things as favorable and this unfavorable. I don't know what's going to happen. I haven't told anybody. I wonder how. That erroneous attitude. But if you just do the best from moment to moment, whether you had a phone or no phone, you try your best from moment to moment and let things unfold as they may. You can't change anything. It's already raining outside. Why, my friend, should it start raining inside? This is something you have to ask yourself across the board. Conditions are already difficult outside. Why should I increase it by confusion inside? So this energy is harnessed from and in consciousness, and it resides in the mind, causing unrest till it is resolved. And how do we go about resolving this? Usually, attempts at resolving all this increase the likes and dislikes because they are cosmetic at best. And this becomes a vicious cycle that generates more and more turmoil. Even making a phone call, doing all of that is still on the outer. The baseline when it comes to, I do my best, I do everything that needs to be done, and to let things happen as they will, is not an I don't care or cavalier attitude towards things, but it is I do care deeply. I cannot change that which is happening, but I can do my very best from moment to moment. And let's see how things turn out. As long as the mind is not quiet, conditioning does not cease. The noise of the mind is conditioning. It is a sign that something is not quite right. Something is not healthy. Just like when you go to a doctor, they start off with checking your vitals and your signs, because it gives them an idea right on the outset from some simple tests, looking at you, taking your pulse, all of that, if the system is healthy. Unless conditioning ceases, the mind does not reach quiescence. We have talked about this conditioning a lot, and it should be quite clear. Conditioning is all the notions that we have about things. And until those notions cease, and these notions have to cease, will cease when we find a way to engage life without them. When you don't need something, and when you don't use it, it weakens by disuse. Because how have these notions become all that important? How have they gained all this importance? By using them. You have a notion about things, and you repeatedly engage that notion, and that notion assumes a sense of reality even more than the object the notion is about. You have a notion about a person. Gradually, the person becomes unimportant because the notion replaces that person. John is a rude person or something like that. Now, it's no longer John that you see anymore. You see a rude person whenever you see John coming, or Ram, or whoever he is or she is. And this is how notions about people and about things replace them. And we have to be very careful about not having these notions replace them. Does that mean we become a sort of doormat that everything's okay? No. Deal with things as they happen. If someone or something is being rude right now, they are being rude right now. What does it have to do with you? Your job, my job, is to just be good. You be good from moment to moment. When you're good, goodness resides in you. And the fruits of goodness are peace and happiness and joy. If someone else is choosing to be non-good, ungood, or something other, rude or whatever, let them get it off their chest and do what they need to be done and move on. But what are all these notions about them? Where does that come into play and why is that essential? My friends, where do these notions arise? I mean, abide. They abide in us. So if you don't like somebody, where does the don't like abide? Where does it live? Where does it stay? In us. When we don't like somebody, don't like stays in us. And is don't like a good experience, a positive experience, or other? No, it's not a positive experience. Dislike is experience. When it resides in us, we experience dislike. When like resides in us, that's what we experience. Quite simply put, my friends, get away from all this philosophy. We smell the flowers in our own garden. Plant what you would like to smell. Plant what you would like to see. And it's as simple as that. The yamas and niyamas of yoga are an excellent restorative prescription for all these reactions. I know we've been talking about it, but slightly philosophically. Getting down to brass tacks, how do we work on these likes and dislikes? How do we thin them? And is there a way, a prescription for healthy living beyond these likes and dislikes? My friends, that's where the yamas and niyamas of yoga come in. I've got a series on yoga, on Raja Yoga, where the first two videos are on these yamas and niyamas. May I request that if you can kindly see those, they're on YouTube and my website. I think they will shed light on the topic very well because they're about 20 minutes or so each. And if you can watch them, we go in depth into the yamas and niyamas and how they work. They are a prescription for habitual reactions of the mind and simple living. And this has to become the basis or the foundation on which the goal of self-realization will be put and by which the mind will be reset gradually. Just in a calm pond, as we've spoken about before, my friends, the bottom reflects itself. Similarly, when we thin out all this agitation from the mind, the knowledge of truth begins to be seen. The knowledge of true being or of self begins to come into the plane of awareness. So cessation of mental conditioning and the realization of the truth are interdependent. They cannot happen without one another. We cannot sit and meditate for 14 hours and then not work out all of this mental conditioning or baggage we have. That will cancel out any effort and make futile any effort that we put forth, no matter how great. We could sit as a statue and meditate 23 hours a day. But if that 1 hour that we are going to feed the serpents, it does us no good. It does absolutely no good. It's like this, my friend. You have a house and you have a real good alarm system. Or you have a car and you have a good alarm system. But you keep it on for 22 hours a day. You turn them off for 2 hours a day. Sooner or later, somebody is going to realize that car or that home is not armed or not alarmed for 2 hours and come there in full force at just that time. What does the 22 hours of having your alarm on do? What does it do? Doesn't accomplish anything at all. So, my friends, this cessation of mental conditioning is addressed first and foremost by having a system of healthy living where things that I should avoid and ways in which I should function as a preference or instead, these are called the yamas and niyamas. The yamas and niyamas have been called by many different names, canons and things of that kind and righteous living, all of that. Perhaps all of that is true, but in a very simple way, things that are not that suitable or conducive to my goal and things that are. So as long as I know this, it's not a question of rejecting something. It's just a question of better choices instead. Is there a way to live with healthier choices that will help me towards a goal or self-realization? And that is at the essence of the Yamas and Niyamas. We come to the third point for today, inner assent, a thought before we begin. Abidance has a steep price tag up front, and this is total sincerity. One has to be fully on board the train of change and be willing to restructure all and everything in ways that support the goal. Okay, my friends, we are on the third point. We have a long agenda today, seven things to discuss. We're on number 3 of 7. This inner quiescence is inner quietude. This inner quietude is the thinning down to stilling down of mental conditioning or the noise of the mind. When you stop agitating the pond, the bottom can be seen. When we stop agitating the mind, our true nature can be seen. We still need to see that whole process of looking within comes into the gamut of meditation, but we cannot even begin to do that with a mind that is turbulent. So we have to abide in ourselves, and abiding or remaining in ourselves, our true nature, or in pure being, for even a little while, the mind gradually starts to get absorbed in itself. When the sense of being inquires or looks into its own self, it is pulled by its own self, because you've got true being looking into its own self, and when like looks at like, there is a gravitational pull between them. And we gradually get established in that state. The more you make this cycle of making self-inquiry, self-knowledge, an important or critical part or focus of main effort, as it is called, it will start feeding on itself and it'll get absorbed in itself. The mind has got scattered because we have made so many things the focus of our effort. The focus of my effort at home, the focus of my effort at work, the focus of my effort here, there, and everywhere else. So we've got so many competing focuses. Some of them are absolutely in conflict with one another. And we have a mind that is at war with itself. So when it abides in itself for even a moment, to abide in itself, it has to look within itself. For that, it has to not be looking out or be pulled out. The Yamas and Niyamas that we have just discussed earlier are a restorative, a prescription for that, to make the mind healthy so it is not looking at its notions of likes and dislikes and all of that, to thin all of that out. This cycle, my friends, of abiding in one's true nature replaces the previous cycles of conditioning. This for that purpose, this for that purpose. When this purpose and that purpose is taken out, and you learn to do things because it needs to be done wholeheartedly, the for this purpose, for that purpose, the conditions, when all that is taken out, conditioning is weakened and the mind begins to get clear. And gradually, it starts to, this cycle, this new healthy cycle, starts to feed on itself. This abidance is a much, much healthier way to uproot mental conditioning than to push ourselves directly and try to do it by sitting hours and hours in contemplation or meditation. Meditation has its place, but meditation is not going to sit if we open the back door to conditioning the rest of the time of our work today or normal life. You can come and sit diligently in meditation 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. But if we are going to feed or nurture conditioning, my friends, you have to ask yourself if that is a healthy way to go about things. So this abidance is a wholehearted embrace of one goal, one focus as the main focus that threads all the aspects of our life. everything. And so it brings everything, though they be different. This is at work, the environment, and boom, the environment is different at workplace, at home, at whatever else. That's only the environment. The same thing is going on. You are doing the very same thing, which is doing what needs to be done as it needs to be done because it needs to be done. Why can this prescription not work at home and in the office and in your recreation and in the other aspects of your life? Why should everything have it a different purpose? And if it has a different purpose, what threads your life? Really not much. You have to ask yourself, what threads or connects everything into my life? And if there's nothing that threads it, what can promote harmony? Nothing can, because there's nothing running through it. So if I have to have harmony in my life, there has to be a string that runs through everything. That string is this abidance. So abidance has a steep price tag up front. And what is that? Total sincerity. Sincerity is to be fully on board that which you have found to be for your highest good. For nothing else, no exterior purpose, not because it's written somewhere or said somewhere, because it just makes sense. As simple as that. You have to be fully on board the train of change and be willing to restructure all and everything in a way that supports the goal. Then the sincerity becomes a link or a thread that runs, or a chain that runs through all the activities. And all the activities, though they may appear to be different, really are being done for the same purpose, which is to bring order into this mind, to gradually get rid of conditioning and make this mind calm. For what purpose? So our true nature can be seen. And all activities, no matter what, contribute to that one goal of self-knowledge. You know, my friends, this is like a mega big payback. Why? Not only are you able to do things wholeheartedly and do them well, whether it's your job or work or family or whatever it is. So there's gain on that side by being able to do things wholeheartedly. And there's gain on the inner dimension by being able to promote the sincerity, by being able to bring about clarity and peace of mind. And so we are working on multiple dimensions at the same time. Why is that not a better way to do things instead of just doing things on the outer plane? Everything on the outer plane is in time process. Here now, not here the next moment, not here the next day. But when we are also promoting inner clarity, inner peace, inner awareness, sense of being is not in time process. That who that you truly are is aware of time process. It is the same awareness that was there when you were a youngster. It is the same awareness that is there now. It'll be the same awareness that'll be there a little bit older. That awareness doesn't change. The body has gone through its changes. The mind may have gone through a lot of its own changes of its notions, but there's something that is aware of all of that. As you anchor and contribute towards that awareness, so that one may be, that awareness may be self-aware. Usually that awareness is aware only of all the notions. This I like, this I don't like. This is a good person, that is not a good person. This is a good thing, that is indifferent, or whatever else. This sense of awareness is aware of its own notions. That is caused by careless living, and that causes all of our sorrow. Oh, that which I didn't like or didn't want to happen is happening. What do I do about it? Why is it so? I didn't want it to rain, and now it's raining. Oh my goodness. It's already raining. And now when we have that attitude towards the rain, it's raining inside also. For the outside, I can have an umbrella. But what do you have for the inside when sorrow, when it rains sorrow? There's no umbrella, my friend. So you experience it. There has to be a better way. And yoga is that better way. And restructuring all of this is the way to that. So this sincerity is the key. This is what we have talked about. What if one is not able to muster this level of sincerity upfront, which is required? Then meditation and contemplation is the other means. Study, meditation, contemplation, gradually looking at the mind, observing the mind, and seeing till we come to the conclusion that that which I want to go beyond, I am causing myself. I myself am the sorrow. I myself am not only the cause, but I am itself the sorrow that I experience, and this is no good. So we have to come to that gradually. Also, the practices of Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga will help us a lot. In Karma Yoga, you learn how to do things on its own merit because it needs to be done. Without any other druthers, without anything else, you learn to do things in spite of the mind's reactions while watching them, while being aware of them, to learn how to do things. You take that from the field of Karma Yoga and you take that technology or that ability and you apply it across the gamut of your life. So you learn something that you can apply in life. And in Bhakti Yoga, you increase your love for the higher, for God, for good, for the better. When your mind starts loving it and you find a way of going beyond the mind, gradually you're able to get to the state of abidance that we have talked about. So that is another way, is to go through things gradually up the rungs of yoga. And if you've made sufficient progress, then you can tackle straight into meditation and to those aspects, but still not ignoring the earlier rungs. Yoga is a complete system that has been very well thought out for a long time by our ancestors, by those who have gone before us. And they have left this as a gift to all mankind, as a better way to live, a better way to be, that is there for one and all. And it doesn't quarrel with any religion or with anything else. It simply says, you have to be careful of not just things outside, but you have to be careful. The care has to be given to our own mind, to our own reactions. And this is at the crust and focus of the initial rungs of yoga. Now we come to number 4, control of mind. A thought before we begin. This samsara, or world appearance, begins to appear as an appearance as one gets firmly established in one's true nature with persistent effort for a considerable time. Now I know, my friends, when we mention, or when I mention up front, considerable effort for a considerable amount of time, we can say, oh my goodness, this is too difficult. How long am I cut out for all this? But I have to mention that, but let's start off with things a little bit closer first. When one has firm resolve, the path becomes much easier. This is at the heart of the question, can we have firm resolve of what is good for us so we can steer clear of choices that are not as good and instead make choices that are good, that are conducive to the goal that we ourselves have selected, no one else. And this is why a very good foundation, Yoga Vashishtha's, Vashishtha's foundation, comes into play. And he's discussed a foundation of 4 things that he calls the centennials, or the century to the palace or fort of liberation. And these 4 are Sama, or control of self. This Sama includes the Yamas and Niyamas working at the same time. So avoiding that which is not conducive and healthier choices instead. That brings about control of self. Now for this, naturally, the mind has also got to be observed relentlessly without remission. And this is the second point, or the second centennial, called vicharana, or the state in which the mind is continuously or constantly observed. So you have Sama, Shama, or control of self, that comes about with the yamas and niyamas both into play at the same time. The second one is vicharana, where the mind is observed relentlessly. Now for this second one, my friends, we have to bring about some order in our life, especially today with all this technology and all this so-called connected stuff, which is actually not connected, it is disconnected, but we'll talk about that another time. I'm sure that you'd like to know about that. The more you try to connect outwardly, the more you disconnect from yourself. There's no doubt in my mind about this. I'm not anti-technology. This is happening with technology, but we have to be careful about how it's used. So this mind that is observed constantly while we are doing everything, how much do we observe the mind while we are doing it? That's why we react to things when we are doing things. If we are looking within, we wouldn't be reacting. We wouldn't go up and down. This will be accepted. This is not good. What will they think of this? It is not good enough. All of this notion, if the energy while we are doing is going towards some of this, how efficiently are we doing what needs to be done as it needs to be done? So vicharana is while we are doing what is best, that control of shama, which is the yamas and niyamas altogether, the mind is also watched at the same time. And you might say, how can I put my mind on my work, on something else, wholeheartedly, and at the same time watch my mind also? How is that possible? My friends, you're not watching two screens. It's not like two television screens or computer screens that you are watching. Where are you aware of what's happening outside in the mind? Where are the reactions of the mind and all of that happening in the mind? Are they happening in two different minds? No. Are you different or disconnected from that mind in which it is happening in a fundamental manner? Not really. It's happening within you, or how could it be, or is it happening somewhere else? Are there two, three within you places? You may say that there are levels of things, one that is aware and one where it is happening. But in its very basis, are those disconnected from each other? You have to ask yourself all of this. So the mind can be observed totally, along with things outside, things inside. All awareness happens in the same plane, in the same consciousness. So that vicharana is the second centennial to liberation. The third centennial or the third century is santosha. Santosha is contentment. Contentment doesn't mean that you give up and you just sort of, okay, however things happen. Not like that, not like that at all. Santosha, this contentment, is doing our best and accepting the rest. Let's see where the chips fall. And okay, this is how it's happened. Why should I get disappointed if I've given whatever had to be done my 100%? See, my friends, this calls for a rewiring of your mind. To equate success and accomplishment with doing well, doing wholeheartedly, doing your best, rather than result, rather than reward, rather than fruit, rather than outcome. Outcome, reward, fruit, and all of that, one cannot control. It's going to happen one way or the other. But our inner attitude is within our control. So why should I equate success to something that is not in my control? And it's guaranteed if I do that, unhappiness, sorrow, all of that is guaranteed. I'm going to fluctuate like a yo-yo. That's guaranteed. But if I equate success with doing wholeheartedly, that is in my control. And I will always be successful whether someone recognizes it, appreciated it or not. Ask yourself, all of nature functions like this, my friends. Does the songbird, beautiful songbird, does it feel sad if anyone doesn't appreciate its singing? No, it sings. Why does it sing? Because it's its nature. It gets a lot of joy when it sings. What if you don't appreciate it? It doesn't get depressed, my friends, and it doesn't complain. It sings. Why can't we too sing across the entire spectrum of our life? Why can't our life be a song, a celebration, doing wholeheartedly because it needs to be done as it happens, as it unfolds, and let it go? The songbird doesn't worry about anyone appreciating its song. It doesn't worry if there are 10 people below the tree and no one looks up. It sings. Why? Because it's its nature. Why can't we too sing? Do what needs to be done as a song, a beautiful song. So that is where Santosha comes in. Contentment. Doing what needs to be done on its own merit, because it needs to be done, when and as it needs to be done, and letting it go, and then doing the next thing. Whether the next thing is doing something very actively or enjoying a cup of tea, it doesn't make a difference. Why can't we be like that? So you have to ask yourself. These are the things that Vasishtha has laid out, a prescription to control the mind and make the mind healthy. So Shama, the first one, or control of self, which comes from the Yamas, Niyamas. Then Vicharana, or mind that is constantly observed. Do one thing at one time to do it wholeheartedly so that mind can be observed. We can bring it into the field of observation. Then Santosha, which is a realignment of our total way of functioning, doing things on its own merit as it needs to be done. And lastly, Satsanga, or company of the wise. Now, my friends, this last one is often, very often misunderstood as Satsanga means a program. Means you must get together at 5 o'clock and have a program and start off with this hymn, and we do that and then put some fruit or something on the table out there, and then the mind is still functioning in its unhealthy ways. No, Satsanga is not just that. Sangha means to come together. Sat is auspicious. Sat is that which is good. Auspiciousness, coming together. In Satsanga, you come together with the best in all things at all times. It may involve a sort of program where you get together in prayer or in things like that, or have some, but it's not limited to that. Satsanga is an all the time thing. When you have this, you choose to come together with that which is healthy. It may come indirectly. If there are no people, you may have books. And today with technology, you have so many videos that are available to you, audios and things like that. And you can, a lot of research that's on the internet and available to you. So it is healthier choices at all times. Sangha and Sat, coming together with that which is good, with that which is auspicious, with that which helps the flowering of consciousness, to put it another way. So Satsanga is company of the wise, better choices at all times. This could and should include coming together with those that have been on the path, that are steadily on the path, because when many candles are brought into the room just gets brighter. And you go back with the collective impact of all the light that has come together at that time. So rather than fight against the current of habit, which is at the heart of what we are trying to discuss, why not cut new grooves instead and let the old ones weaken by disuse? These four that we have just discussed, Shama, or control of self, Vicharana, or a mind that is constantly observed, Santosha, or contentment, and Satsanga, or company of the wise, are a prescription to go beyond habit, to allow habit to weaken by disuse. While setting this new foundation, it is also important to stop feeding the old habits. So these four things that we have discussed are laying the new foundation. While we do that, we avoid the old habits. You have to have the inner strength to avoid the old habits. Satsang becomes very, very useful, as we have discussed earlier. So, to avoid all these old habits, the important thing is, why do we function on those habits? What is so strong about those habits? There is a sense of value that we have prescribed to habit. This makes me feel happy. So, when we don't do that habit, we feel a little bit unhappy for a moment, for a little while. But this unhappiness is a fake unhappiness. This sorrow that we feel, sort of regret, remorse, vacuum, is a false sorrow. It's a false high. If we go beyond that, not by just strength grinding it, but by instead the better choices based on those four things we have just talked about, on those four centennials, we can go beyond this, and it takes a little bit of self-effort, but if it's handled as a sense of duty, no, better choices instead. I'm not only going to do what promotes joy in the moment, I'm also going to do what promotes my well-being beyond the moment. And habit does not promote well-being beyond the moment because it cuts grooves in the mind that seek repetitious involvement, and that promotes instability of mind. So we are not talking of abandoning everything that may give pleasure. But the important thing is, can we abandon the pursuit of pleasure and instead take pleasure from the simple joys that come naturally? This pursuit of pleasure is what promotes displeasure or unhappiness. Whenever you chase after something, you're out of breath. When you chase after something that you think is going to promote happiness, all that chasing is unhappiness. Wondering, will it come, will it not come? How will this has changed, that has changed. So pursuit is all that is unhappiness for a little bit of what we call happiness. This pursuit of pleasure, can that be abandoned completely? And let the joys, let the pleasures, natural joys come naturally as they may. Can we take delight in that? These are called simple joys. They are not the result of pursuit. And that is the key thing. They're the result of the feelings of delight in things as they come about. Oh, there is that little bird singing. How beautiful. Oh, this has happened. These simple joys that come about are not often experienced in our life because we always want the joys that we pursue. So actually, we disallow the simple and natural joys, which are the blessings in life. They are beautiful. They come about all the time. A beautiful bird singing, a beautiful sunset. But we are too busy, wrapped up in our own world, to even be aware of the beautiful sunset, the sky with so many beautiful colors, or the smell of the ocean as you sit behind it, or a walk in the mountains and things like that, or anything else, such simple, beautiful joys. Why can't we be aware of them? The beautiful colors on a bird or a butterfly. So gradually, the mind is rendered stable and one can advance one's practice to focus on inner quiescence, eradication of mental conditioning, and direct knowledge of the truth. These are three things that have to be practiced in the inner court, in the inner dimension, for which you need a mind that is rendered stable. These four centennials will render the mind stable. It is a prescription for healthier living. That will allow something else to go on, which is to bring about further quiescence of mind, eradication of mental conditioning, which leads to direct knowledge of truth. That is to happen. This is why we have to find a healthy way of living, not just because it's been written down or taught. When these three things, further quiescence of mind, eradication of mental conditioning, and direct knowledge of truth, or seeking direct knowledge of truth, are practiced for a while, steadily, the knots of ignorance in the heart are rent asunder. They are opened. They are weakened. Then what happens? This samsara, or world appearance, begins to be seen as an appearance again, as one gets established in one's own nature. With persistent effort for a considerable amount of time, or steadily, one gradually gets established in one's own nature. One of the other things besides these four that we have talked about that really helps, that maybe should be brought into the gamut of this practice we are talking about, is pranayama. Pranayama, or the restraint of prana, or life force, has equal value in the destruction of vasana, or conditioning, and so practice pranayama also. In the video series on Raja Yoga, my friends, I've talked about the simple pranayama and asanas. Sukhapurvak pranayama, or simple basic pranayama, and some basic asanas. Practice of all this is very important, not just for the asanas, for posture and all of that. But in practicing asana and pranayama, one really knows or understands how to look within. There's an inner dimension in yoga, which is perhaps more important than just the outer dimension. Prana is controlled by pranayama. The practice of yoga, asanas, healthy eating, all of that also help bring about a sort of inner balance, restore an inner balance, among other methods. I won't talk about it much more over here, my friends, because it's there in a video on pranayama. Please take some time to watch that video. You'll find it useful. We now come to the fifth point for today, the cause and cure of samsara. A thought before we begin. When these likes and dislikes are abandoned, the heart is purified and one is liberated. No longer affected by pain and pleasure, good fortune and misfortune. Okay, my friends, we've been going for a while. We are now on the fifth point. I know we've been going on and on, but I'm trying to hammer this or look at it from many different ways and practical living at the same time. What is the cause behind all the samsara that we have? And what is the cure? What is the way out of this in a very simple way? We've talked about it. We're going to bring it up again. And we're going to discuss this again and again till it floods the area of our consciousness. Contact of the ego with its own conditioning, with its own likes and dislikes, is the cause and sustenance of samsara. It's as simple as that. The contact of the ego with its own conditioning. This conditioning does not belong to something other than the ego, and it doesn't reside in some place other than the mind. So all this can be resolved because it's all happening in the same plane. Contact of the ego with its own conditioning, which is the likes and dislikes, are the cause and sustenance of samsara. So if that sense of ego first is made to do what needs to be done on its own merit, without contact for that, we're going to break one cycle. Then if we go beyond the ego by doing what needs to be done purely on its own merit, the I and my, or the ego, doesn't even come into play. So this ego and its likes and dislikes is a vicious cycle that can be gone beyond by in a healthier way of living. And gradually, these likes and dislikes can be abandoned and the heart can be purified. When you engage a different mechanism, a different way of living, you can weaken the existing mechanism by disuse. And this is at the basis of what Vasishtha has said for a long time. Then what happens? When you do what needs to be done, because it needs to be done on its own merit, one is no longer affected by pain and pleasure, fortune and good fortune. And why is that? Because everything is on its own merit. We don't do things because it's going to promote our joy or not bring pain. When you leave all that confusion behind and bring about this clarity, all of that is forgotten. So what is the cure? This is the cure. To do what needs to be done on its own merit, just because it needs to be done, when it needs to be done. So you don't worry about a whole lot of things. You learn to streamline your focus. The important word here is to do it wholeheartedly. To do everything wholeheartedly, which means to be fully on board, is the only way to free and refrain from contact with existing conditioning. Existing conditioning is going to try and suggest very strongly, because of this, because of that, not this, this will come, that will not come. But when you disregard that, By instead doing everything on its own merit, you weaken the whole force of conditioning. Conditioning cannot function when you embrace life as duty, because the idea of selfishness, gain, all of that is taken out of the picture completely. Gradually, you get established in the state of equanimity. In equanimity, this balanced mind that we are talking about, what happens? The mind is no longer stirred up reactively, and it begins to rest on itself. You're still doing everything that needs to happen, but the mind is not stirred up, roused up reactively all the time. When that mind is not stirred up reactively, those waves fall on the mind, and the mind starts to gather itself in itself by itself. This doesn't happen all at one stroke. So it's advisable for one who is intent on spiritual progress to lead a disciplined life, an orderly life, a regulated life, while restoring the mind and the heart. This regulated life is not punitive, but positive. And anything that is positive is joy-giving, joy-promoting. Number 6, avoid conceptualization. A thought before we begin. A wise person lives without the thought of what has been or what has not been experienced, and does what needs to be done wholeheartedly on its own merit. Friends, we have been talking about this conceptualization, but let's break it down and make it simple. What exactly is a concept? When one wishes, "May this be mine," such desire or thought is called as a concept, because we do not really know what this is, what the object is, and it's based on an erroneous notion of what this object is. Secondly, it's always based on the notion, this will promote happiness, this will not promote happiness. Those are further notions. So when notions come into the field of practice, they are looked at as concepts. Therefore, all thinking or remembering is conceptualization, because it is based on notions of the object and without any real basis at all. When the mind is not desire, only the object is. The object is there. And the corresponding thought or concept is gradually abandoned. Now you might think, my friend, and we've talked about this before, that when we don't desire for anything, our life becomes dry and dreary. No. But what does desire have to do with enjoying things that come along naturally in our life? Desire is what promotes dissatisfaction. What I desire is not happening. What I don't desire is happening. When we have that, we promote dissatisfaction. And we don't look at the natural joys that we have just spoken about earlier. But can we not enjoy things that come naturally without all this artificial stimulation? What I desire, what I don't desire. That is going to happen, which is going to happen. Do your best and accept the rest. Let it happen. This abandonment of desire is usually misunderstood as a rejection of all things outright. It isn't a rejection. You may need to simplify your life or the outer, and this may be necessary till you can bring about inner simplification at the very root, at the sense of being, to rid the mind of all these currents of likes and dislikes. There may need to be an outer simplification. When you have an outer simplification, you are not overly enamored or pulled by all of that. You can watch the inner more clearly. When the outer is very complicated, and our outer life is very complicated, this inner understanding becomes difficult, my friends. It becomes a challenge, because all that outer stuff interferes while this inner observation is taking place. So you may need to simplify your life till you can simplify the inner, or get rid of these strong currents of likes and dislikes. You have to see these likes and dislikes. You cannot see them if at the same time you are involved in a lot of this likes and dislikes and what will be acceptable and what is not, and all of that complicated stuff that may exist in our life. You may have to change things a little bit. A wise person lives without the thought of what has been or what has not been experienced, and does what needs to be done wholeheartedly on its own merit because it needs to be done. Vashishtha gives us a very beautiful example towards this. He says, he functions, the wise functions as the feet of one who walks functions without volition of desire. Now, without volition or desire. This is often misunderstood that you just lead a plain Jane monotone life. No, not that, my friends. Do what needs to be done, do it wholeheartedly, but the joy that comes from doing wholeheartedly is greater than the joy from a wish, may I feel, may I experience this, or may I experience that, and 10 times that we don't, and one time that we do. The joy of doing wholeheartedly is a continual stream of blessing. Because it always happens. It always works. That's why Krishna tells us in the Gita, in the second chapter, Karmanyevadhikarasya, do what needs to, your job is simply to do duty, not the fruits thereof. Once again, bring back to mind that functioning without volition or without desire does not mean living joylessly, but rather living joyfully, because joy is always there. If you associate joy with wholehearted performance, and since everything, no matter how mundane, can be performed wholeheartedly, joy is continually there in your life. When you go the other way, that things that happen my way, things that don't happen, things I prefer, things I would rather avoid, your joy oscillates like a yo-yo at best. So you have to ask yourself about which one of these is joy promoting and joy disallowing. Now, my friends, we come to the seventh and last topic for the day. I had mentioned earlier that it was going to be a long one, and it has turned out to be. But these are all important points. The seventh topic, relentless self-inquiry. A thought before we begin. You are never alone in the spiritual path. So rest on the belief that help comes when one strives sincerely. Sincerity and self-effort merge in the call to grace. Friends, we're going to spend some time on this last seventh topic because it is at the heart of it all. The first six that we've talked about bring us to this seventh state of relentless self-inquiry. This is what needs to happen. This is not disassociated from laying the foundation. It is all one staged ascent. So we have discussed six important points so far. The heavy work of the spiritual path is in transforming the mind from the habitual to the natural. That is a heavy work. That is the foundation, and it cannot be ignored. If that work is not done up front, meditation can be a struggle. Meditation can be something that you would rather not do. Meditation is something that you could rather skip. Meditation would seem challenging at best. So this is essential. All these earlier ones are essential for self-inquiry, because there is no other instrument for inquiry but the mind itself. And that's why we are told in the Gita and in the Vashishtha to raise the mind by the mind, to inquire into the mind with the mind. There is no other instrument. You cannot buy it. You cannot purchase it. You cannot get it from somewhere else. You cannot find it online, nowhere. The source of the mind is the source of being, and this has to be realized or become real to us by direct experience. If the heavy work is not done up front, my friends, it will take a bigger toll later especially later when age and all of its brothers come along, all of its afflictions that come along. In the old days, my friends, in ancient days, knowledge of yoga, along with the goal of life and its attainment, was taught at the same time with secular subjects which one would learn, by which one would earn one's livelihood. This was a very important foundation, and these days have gone. Those days have gone. This is why it seems almost like an alien path when we come to it. The what was guided by the why. What to do was guided by the why we are doing it in the first place. And therefore, the how about all things, how it's to be done, became very clear. This understanding of this triad of what, why, and how is not there in the education system today at all. It has not been there for a long time, so I'm not knocking the education system. It's just the way things have changed. The what was guided by the why. What am I to do? But first you have to ask yourself why. There are many what's, but if the why is clear, so that I cultivate the mind, so that I do all this, then the what will be also clear. You will not do those things that do not promote, like do wrong things or whatever of that kind. And you will do all things in the right manner. The how will become clear. So the why was a very important bridge in the middle of what, which is what we see in day-to-day life. This needs to be done, this needs, everything is laid out, all the what's. But the why is not there, and therefore, there are many different hows. The how at work is one thing, the how at home is another thing. Something that we find personal, we take a personal interest in, the how becomes different. The how changes based on the what, because this bridge, the connecting link in the middle, the why is absent. This why is what threads all the things in our life. This understanding was taught in earlier days, and this has long been forgotten. This sharp focus allowed one to progress through the different stages of life gradually and make progress in not just one's life, but in every life journey that we come into towards a grand path or grand goal of self-realization. Those days, along with their structure, are long past. But we still have the same goals in life. This whole system is gone. But we still have the same goal. The goal has not changed. That has not changed. So being unaware of it is not an excuse. Just like ignorance of the law is no excuse. Wherever we reside, ignorance of the law is no excuse. So what is the challenge before us? Can we come to this understanding and accepting of the lofty goal of realization? The understand this is why we do everything, so gradually our self nature, our true nature may be seen. So we have to come to that conclusion, but there's a lot of things that are helpful for us today. Take advantage of the availability of so many aids that we have with the advent of technology. And we have a lot of things that are more easily available to us. A lot of good information that in old days was not so easy to attain. You are never alone in the spiritual path. So rest on the belief that help comes when one strives sincerely. Sincerity is the invitation to all the help that you need. That is the only number you need to dial, sincerity. Everything comes based on that one number. Sincerity and self-effort merge in the call to grace. I wanted to talk about these few things to stress really again and again that the heavy work on the spiritual path is non-glorious. It's not like sitting and sometimes, you know, you want to get into meditation and you want to be able to talk about the experience, all of that. All of that glorious self, this early part is non-glorious. But it's a struggle only till you are not fully on board. It's not glorious, but it's not a struggle, my friends. The hard work is a struggle only when you don't accept the facts. Just like if you're a farmer or you like gardening, the heavy work of gardening is laborious. But it doesn't have to be a struggle, does it? Laborious in terms of you've got to cultivate the ground, you've got to do all the planting, you've got to protect the seedling, you've got to do all of that work, watering it, feeding it, nurturing it, for you to have a nice garden. And then you have flowers or fruit or whatever else. But just because it's not glorious doesn't mean it has to be laborious. You can take as much of an interest in all of that planting and as much joy in all of that what you call laborious work as you do from a beautiful flower that has blossomed or a fruit that's ready to eat. So all this, my friends, has to be reorganized within ourselves. Self-inquiry needs a good amount of capital. For self-inquiry, it must have the self. So the self must be cultivated, because with the self, we have to know the self. There is no other instrument by which all this can happen. So Vashishtha tells us, inquire into the nature of truth relentlessly to attain the fruit of this birth. But this inquiry needs an instrument by which we inquire. And we have been talking again and again about cultivating this instrument. Friends, may I suggest one thing, please? Take the idea of gradual work out of the mind completely. As the habitual mind loves this, it will give you trickle-down cooperation, which will at best be one step forward, two steps back. Take this idea out completely and embrace it wholeheartedly and start threading all the aspects of your life. This doesn't mean to get fanatical, but radical change calls for radical moves. And if you take this wholehearted thing, the sooner you do it, this warm embrace, the sooner you'll get the mind's cooperation with it. The struggle is in our own inability or unwillingness to get fully on board the train of change. That's it. That's struggle in a nutshell. So Swami Sivananda has a perfect recipe for all this. Have a firm resolve to write it down, put it in your prayer area or something like that. Second thing, an effective system of self-accountability, like a spiritual diary, where you can write down everything, see what you've done, what you ought to do, etc. And number three, an intelligent system of self-punishment. Now this, my friend, take it beyond all this socially correct and all of that correct way of thinking. All of that stuff doesn't work at all. You haven't done what has to be done in an intelligent way of self-punishment. Okay, I skip my night meal. I instead do a little bit more japa, but send a message to the mind, this is not okay. These three, Swami Sivananda called his Trishul, or trident, which has got three tips. A firm resolve, write it down, put it in your prayer area, effective system of self-accountability, and an intelligent but effective system of self-punishment. With this triad, sit to realize. With this solid foundation, you will be unshaken. Without a foundation, you will be shaken. It is not that distractions and turbulence will be absent soon, but that you will be well grounded and anchored so you can sail over them. See, a good captain of a boat, it's not that they never experience storms, it's that they know how to navigate in spite of the storms. And this is the key in yoga for self-inquiry to happen. Self-inquiry is looking directly into oneself, not thinking or rationalizing. You are not satisfied with an explanation. A direct experience must be had. And what is this inquiry? What is this world and who am I? To sit with that question in your heart till this truth is known, not by answer, not by thought, but by direct experience alone. Such inquiry is the essence of the science of self-knowledge. And the answer will be found in the question itself when you persist. One who engages himself in self-inquiry is fearless, for he knows that the infinite consciousness is pure and is the only truth. You don't abide in the unchanging, so you're not moved by the unchanging, which is what fear and all of the other things are. You learn then to look upon things with equal vision. The wise restrain their senses from apprehending this world appearance. The senses want to run after things based on conditioning. The wise restrain them. This restraint is not a sort of suppression of the outer, but they always have in their pocket healthier choices instead, better choices instead. Whereas those who are unable to rest in the self are prey to their own senses. When this inner awareness is not active and directly engaging life, it engages concepts, it engages conditioning, it engages all that mental baggage. That, my friends, is the recipe for sorrow. So we've discussed many things today, and in these, the first six sort of lay the foundation for the seventh of relentless self-inquiry to begin. Friends, let us briefly summarize the 7 points we've talked about today. 1, the state of pure being. 2, attain a quiet mind first. 3, inner ascent. 4, control of mind. 5, cause and cure of samsara. 6, avoid conceptualization. And 7, relentless self-inquiry. Next time, we begin with the important teachings of the 6th chapter by going a little bit more into depth of some of what we have already covered in our 9th talk together, which we discussed the 7 planes or states of wisdom. But we'll discuss them one at a time over 7 talks. This is a virtual roadmap for the seeker, and we will discuss these one at a time. Though there are 2 parts to the 6th chapter, which is the biggest part of the Yoga Vashishta, we will bring our focus down to these and focus on the most essential teachings together. Friends, thank you for joining me today. To download this video, its audio, or a PDF summary of the main points discussed, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.